The American Embassy in Sudan is located in a well-fortified area just a stone's throw from the Blue Nile River on the western side of Khartoum. It's a relatively new complex of buildings, but it sits in a very tough and violent city. As you may remember, last April, a team of special operations forces completed the difficult mission of evacuating the embassy. Chaos was descending on the city, and it was time to airlift the American diplomats to safety. There were about 100 people at the embassy, and it took less than an hour to get everyone out. The Navy's SEAL Team 6 took part in the mission, which was cloaked in secrecy and executed in darkness. The evacuation was fast and clean, using two MH-47 Chinook helicopters. The American officials said the deteriorating situation required the emergency evacuation because a storm of violence was heading toward the embassy gates. All of us who know Christ are his ambassadors, his representatives in a deteriorating world. And just before the storm of the tribulation's violence hits the gates of the church, our great commander is literally going to airlift us to safety, rescuing us before the storm. Psalm 144 says, "Part your heavens, Lord, and come down. Reach down your hand from on high. Deliver me and rescue me." The Lord delights in his people, in his church, in his family. He delights in you. Yes, we suffer trouble and tribulation in the world, but God always makes a way of escape for us because he delights in us. His deliverance isn't just reserved for the rapture. He wants to deliver you right now from anything that your anxieties about the future or any worries or concerns that are crippling your life. We worship a Savior who saves. What will happen next and what we hope for is what God promised, a new heaven and a new earth where justice reigns. That's 2 Peter 3:13. And Max Lucado in the Encouraging Word Bible says, "History is not an endless succession of meaningless circles, but it has a directed movement toward a great event. God has a timeline. And because of Bethlehem, we have an idea where we stand in it. And as the Apostle John said, dear children, this is the last hour." 1 John 2:18. We enjoy the fruit of his first coming, and we look forward and anticipate the glory of the second. We celebrate the first advent to whet our appetites for the second. We long for the next coming. Chuck Swindoll comments, "For now, earthquakes, wars, famine, lawlessness." Most Christians have some idea of the signs that occur during the time the Bible calls the last days. Well, guess what? We're living in them now. Just about every generation since the New Testament was written has thought the same. Some Christians are fascinated by the mysteries and symbols found in Revelation and love to unravel their secrets. Others feel that Revelation wasn't written for that purpose, so we're best to just avoid it altogether, lest we get sidetracked from our main calling. Well, what's the proper approach? What should we know about the end times? And what, if anything, should we do to live out our faith in the midst of these turbulent times? To be rapture ready. So we hope that these messages have increased your understanding of the important topic and have helped you appreciate the solid truths of the Bible. Pardon me. Usually, we learn from what is stated. Sometimes we learn from the silence of the scriptures. Sherlock Holmes is probably history's favorite detective, and as we all know, he solves his crimes by thinking and noticing what others miss. Do you remember the story of the dog that didn't bark? It started when a famous racehorse named Silver Blaze disappeared the night before the big race. Then came the murder of the horse's trainer. Holmes investigated, and when a Scotland Yard inspector asked him what he had caught his attention, he said, "The curious incident of the dog in the nighttime." "The dog did nothing in the nighttime," said the inspector. "That was the curious incident," replied Sherlock, "because the watchdog didn't bark." Holmes deduced that the culprit was not a stranger to the dog, but someone that the dog recognized. He called this a negative fact, and he later said he solved the case when he grasped the significance of the silence of the dog. There are many times when silence is a powerful witness to the facts. And that's true when it comes to the rapture of the church and the events of the tribulation as we find them in the book of Revelation. I like that verse in Zephaniah 1:7 that reads, "Stand in silence in the presence of the sovereign Lord, for the awesome day of the Lord's judgment is near." Thank you. My apologies. Sometimes we just need to wet our whistle, huh? By now, I hope that we have established our conviction that the rapture occurs next before the tribulation. The curious incident of dead silence regarding the church in the core chapters of Revelation comes alongside that conclusion and helps corroborate it. Many who study the book of Revelation have found it to be one of the best organized books in the Bible. And one particular verse in the first chapter gives us an outline of the entire book. The first half of the first chapter is prologue. And the last part of Revelation chapter 1 is John's initial vision of the glorified Jesus, who told him in verse 19, "Write the things which you have seen, the things which are, and the things which will take place after this." This is God's own framework to the book of Revelation. First, the things you have seen. That's the first chapter. And John's incredible opening vision of Jesus. John was on the island of Patmos in exile. He heard the blast of the trumpet and turned to see the glorious figure of the enthroned Christ, whom he described in magnificent detail. Christ spoke and explained the meaning of all the symbols surrounding him, and the Lord told John to write down this opening vision he had seen. Next, the things which are. And this refers to the next two chapters, Revelation 2 and Revelation 3. And John oversaw these churches as an elder in exile. Each message describes the spiritual health of a given church, accompanied by commendations or reprimands or warnings and rebukes. These messages are applicable throughout the entire age of the church. They are important for us today. And third, the things that will take place after this. And this refers to the core chapters of Revelation, which begin in Revelation 4 and continue through the end of the book. These chapters detail the events that will take place in the future, and almost everything in Revelations 4 through 18 has to do with the seven-year tribulation, describing in great detail the pouring out of God's wrath upon the earth. Chapter 19 is devoted to the second coming of Christ at the end of the tribulation. And do you know what is conspicuously absent from Revelation chapter 4 through 18? The church. The word church appears 19 times in Revelations 1 to 3, but only once, but not once, in Revelation 4 through 18. Why the silence? Because the church will no longer be on the earth. Believers will be removed before the tribulation period and taken to heaven by means of the rapture. You cannot find the church anywhere from Revelation 4 through 18, which deals and describe those 7 years of tribulation upon the earth. And see how the account of the tribulation begins unfolding in Revelation 4. Verse 1 says, "After these things I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven. And the first voice which I heard was like a trumpet speaking to me, saying, 'Come up here, and I will show you things that must take place after this.'" So we shouldn't lose and base our convictions on a single verse about the rapture of the church. But since we have studied the three primary passages already, it's hard not to see some similarities. We have what Sherlock Holmes calls meaningful clues. Actually, several. To start, we see John confronted by heaven through the means of an open door. There's even the possibility that John was drawn up to heaven and that he experienced a precursor to the rapture, as did Enoch and Elijah and Paul. And when did that happen? After these things, which refers to the message that John received for the churches from chapters 2 and 3. And next, not only did John see an open door, he also heard a voice like a trumpet. And where have we heard that before? The great rapture passages in 1 Thessalonians 4 and in 1 Corinthians 15 both refer to the blast of a trumpet. In addition, John heard the command, "Come up here," which must surely be something similar to the shout that Jesus will declare when he comes for us. So in short, the clues offered to us in the first verse of Revelation 4 point strongly to the conclusion about John's experience as a preview of the rapture. John Strombeck affirmed that idea when he wrote, quote, "No event recorded in Revelation can better represent the rapture of the church than John's being caught up to heaven in Revelation 4:1. And while we're at it, here's another amazing coincidence. One phrase is repeated 7 times in Revelation 2 and 3 at the conclusion of each of Christ's messages to the churches. That phrase is a convicting command. "He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." No similar phrase occurs again in Revelation. until we come to chapter 13, in which it's the midpoint of the tribulation when the Antichrist in all of his demonic power to terrorize the world. And at that point, we read in Revelation 13, 9, if anyone has an ear, let him hear. Well, what's missing? The writer no longer said what the Spirit says to the churches. Why? Because the church is no longer around. Dr. Richard Mayhew wrote, it's remarkable and totally unexpected that John would shift from detailed instructions for the church to absolute silence about the church. And if in fact the church continued into the tribulation, then surely the most detailed study of tribulation events would also include an account of the church's role, but it doesn't. Well, simply to summarize, the church is on earth in Revelation 1 through 3, and then there's no record of anything being done by the church in chapters 4 to 18. Evangelism is carried out by 144,000 Jewish evangelists, and the action centers around the nation of Israel. The Spirit says nothing to the church during these terrible years since the church is in heaven. And one only when we get to the account of the second coming of Christ in chapter 19 do we see him coming with his people, the armies in heaven. Well, have we put together the clues? One more thing to think about. The New Testament is chock full of instructions for the church. In fact, from the very first chapter of Romans through the fourth chapter of Revelation, the primary emphasis of the New Testament writers involves how we, as Christians on earth, should conduct ourselves. We're told about morality, our theology, our faith, our behavior, our mission. We're even told how to react to the tribulations of life that we must endure. But these instructions stop when we get to Revelation 4. Finally, John MacArthur agrees. It would be inconsistent for the scriptures to be silent on such a traumatic change for the church. If any time of the rapture other than the pre-tribulational were true, one would expect the epistles to teach that fact. However, there is no teaching whatsoever, so only a pre-tribulational rapture satisfactorily explains such obvious silence. The purpose of the tribulation is to execute God's wrath on those who reject him. It helps us understand why he would want to get the church out of the way to a place of safety, to a heavenly refuge where we will be protected from that wrath. So by simple logic, then, we can see why believers are being spared the tribulation. What would be the point of having to endure it? By turning to God for salvation, our rebellion has been forgiven. We have no need to be purged of it or punished for it. In fact, the Bible tells us clearly that our salvation is a salvation from God's wrath. The Apostle Paul wrote in 1 Thessalonians that we are to wait for his Son from heaven, who he raised from the dead, even Jesus, who delivers us from the wrath to come. For God did not appoint us to wrath, but to obtain salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ. Romans 5:8 makes the same point. Much more than having been justified by his blood, we shall be saved from wrath through him. Oh, our merciful Christ. When God put Jesus on the cross, he exacted from him the full penalty due for your sin, for my sin. We have nothing left to pay. And accordingly, if we who have been cleansed by the blood of Jesus were to be put through the tribulation, a time of punitive judgment from God, it would mean the price that Christ paid for us on the cross was not enough. So the whole idea undermines the sufficiency of Christ's sacrifice for our sin. We will be with Christ. David Jeremiah, in The Great Disappearance, points out that one of the great prophetic themes of the Bible is that God has a plan for history. That plan has phases. And as we've said, the next phase is imminent. It can arrive at any moment. And although life on this earth will continue to get worse, studying biblical prophecy gives us courage in chaotic times. The very pain of these trials reminds us of the day of his coming draws near. All prophecy is by definition focused on the future. Yet it would be a mistake to conclude that biblical prophecy has no value from the present. Quite the opposite is true. In his book, World News and Biblical Prophecy, prophetic scholar Charles Dyer reminds us that God gave us prophecy to change our hearts, not to fill our heads with knowledge. God never predicted future events just to satisfy our curiosity about the future. He includes practical applications of life. God's pronouncements about the future carry with them specific advice for you and I for the here and now. It would not be an exaggeration to say that biblical prophecy drives evangelism and righteous living. Knowing what's coming encourage us to be ministry oriented, to seek the lost and to reach out to help rescue the perishing. Prophecy elevates our perspective. It energizes our walk with the Lord. And God gave us prophecy to help us anticipate what is coming and to equip us for living in the world of the end. John O'Neill, he worked for years as a counterterrorism specialist for the FBI. He investigated many terrorist attacks, including a 1993 attack on the World Trade Center and various bombings throughout the Middle East. And in the late 1990s, O'Neill developed serious concerns about the growing threat of Al-Qaeda and of Osama bin Laden as its leader. O'Neill even prevented an Al-Qaeda attack on the Los Angeles International Airport in 2000. O'Neill shared his deeper worries with U.S. officials. He even told the Associated Press in 1997, a lot of these groups now have the capability and the support infrastructure to attack us here as they choose to do so. Sadly, many of his warnings were heard, but not heeded. After retiring in August 2001, O'Neill accepted the job as chief of security at the World Trade Center. He was killed as he was helping people evacuate the South Tower on September 11th. And the lesson from that story is that warnings are only helpful when they're acted upon. Knowledge of what's to come will benefit us only when we study it and allow it to influence our choices for today. May that be the case for you and me. Let us never forget the incredible gift we have received through the prophetic messages in God's words. Specifically, let us never neglect the key lesson of the rapture. Christ is coming soon. We are servants tasked with critical work in the Master's house. At any moment, he may walk through the door, and we're like young people awaiting the great groom in his heavenly procession. So when he comes, will he find us living wisely or living foolishly? The rapture is both a warning and a promise, an admonition and a blessing. Each breath you take brings you one moment closer to the shout of Christ, the voice of the archangel, and the sound of the trumpet of God. Whoever has ears to hear, let him hear. What kind of people are we to be? Peter tells us, 2 Peter 3:11, you should live holy lives and serve God as you wait for and look forward to the coming of the day of the Lord. Stay alert. Watch out for your great enemy, the devil. He prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Stand firm against him. Be strong in your faith. Stay alert is also an article that I read a little over a week ago in this month's Decision magazine. Ann Graham Lotz writes, on December 7th, Israel was attacked by a brutal, truly demonic way that has turned the Middle East into an explosive powder keg. The alignment of Russia and Iran and Turkey and Syria, Iraq, and parts of northern Africa seem to be a fulfillment of prophecies made by Ezekiel some 2,000 years ago. Prophecies that describe the final conflicts that lead to Armageddon. With rumblings of war between China and Taiwan, the ongoing war in Ukraine, active shooters creating war in our communities, the smash and grab tactics of flash mobs who are at war with civilized behavior, with the exploding sex trafficking that is a wicked war on decency, with gender dysphoria leading to the mutilation of our children in a war against the next generation, the whole world is in turmoil. And at the same time, our nation is being invaded at the borders. What's going on? Could we be drawing to the end? The director of the FBI recently revealed there's a dangerous chatter online indicating an imminent terrorist attack on America. His warning urging Americans to stay alert seems appropriate also for the followers of Jesus Christ, who said we who may be very well living at the end of human history as we know it. In Matthew 24, Jesus concluded his prophecy by challenging his disciples to stay alert by watching, by working, by walking with him, keeping pace with his timing. And Anne concludes, while we can't predict when Jesus will return, we do know he is coming. And one day, either at his return or our death, we will stand face to face before him. If you and I live our lives expecting to see Jesus in the next 5 minutes and we don't, what have we lost? Nothing. What have we gained? Everything. So stay alert. You can't lose, and you sure will be glad you did. Selah.